Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 8, delivered on February 4, 2016. The title of this lecture is Present Value and Future Value.
Today, Present Value and Future Value. This is pretty compact lecture, not a tough subject at all. It gets a little bit hairier in chapter 4, but even there, the thing of it is that for what I'm showing you today, really the formula is the fastest way to do these kinds of calculations. Now, for more extended versions of it that I'll do next week, the financial calculator is probably your best friend. For God's sake, don't use the tool, those tables that are in the backs of finance and accounting textbooks. That is real old school, and it's actually not even as informative as using a financial calculator to do these. And there are some people who are still using tables out there in industry, but realistically, you're going to use a financial calculator or a calculator with financial functions, or you're going to be using Excel spreadsheets to do the kind of work, this kind of stuff. But as I said, for these simple problems, problems that are involving just lump sums of money that you're pulling back to the present or throwing forward into the future, realistically, the fastest way is just to key in the formula and go from there. Let me show you real quick here. Okay. Bear with me here one moment. Document camera. Oh, really? I'm going to pull a piece of paper here and just toss a couple of problems, just show you the problems. They're nothing really that difficult. Before I do that, though, there's a thing about what we're doing here that goes back to what I talked about in the last lecture. The law of one price and the valuation principle. The idea that if we have, there is a scientific certainty to an answer in finance. It is not an opinion about, well, this could be this way or it could be that way. And this has the impact that if we are to value money in the future, say there are two cash flows, $100 in a year, $200 in 2 years, then we look at another project that has the same cash flows. Those two projects would have the same value. Because they'd have the same, and therefore they'd have the same price, or vice versa. They'd have the same price, and then they'd have the same value, unless the interest rate was different for the two projects. And that's something that you do have to think about in a longer-term context. But one of the questions that you'll run into on the test has to do, and I'm going to give you a variation on this. You, sir, have decided that you are going to be a cat breeder, okay? And you are, too. You're in competition with each other. And over here, we have a cat breeder, too. Okay, now, you can sell these cats for $1,000, each of these cats. They're very special cats, just like my cats are very special cats. Okay, $1,000. These are very valuable cats. Well, you see, you are emotionally, you bond with the cats. I mean, it's just like all of a sudden you see it and it's your baby. Same with you. Okay? So, but you actually hate cats. Actually, cats hate you and you developed a hatred of them. They just, you know, there's something about you that reminds them of a dog. I don't know. But you hate cats, okay? So now, Is the value of the cats to you different from the value of the cats to these two?
No.
That's exactly right. There's absolutely nothing about your feelings that enter an objective market. You're going to see on the first test, I'm going to lead you up to the first test where you write answers for me. Something that I try to get you never to do in a business course is to start a sentence with, and you would not believe how many people try to do this, I feel, or I believe, or I think that. Don't ever talk about feelings or beliefs or your thoughts. Just give me a damn answer and be done with it. Leave your feelings for when you're listening to Kenny G at night in the dark when you're alone and sad. And did I mention alone? Yeah. Okay. In business, we don't have feelings about things, about the objects of our sale. I had this interview last year with a reporter for ISU, for ISU Stories, about my landscape photography. And she wanted me to talk about my passion for what I was doing. And I said, bitch, no. Oh, I didn't. Don't talk to me about passion. I'm creating something to sell it. That's all. If I have a passion, I'm not going to share it with you. Don't ever share your feelings with a girl. God, I mean, that's not manly. Look at your man card, will be taken away, okay? Your feelings don't matter. And I want to emphasize that it is an objective price. You can sell the cat for $1,000. Doesn't matter whether you love it or hate it. It's $1,000 for the pussycat. I don't know if anyone's been that blunt with you yet in business, but I'm old. I'm going to die. I don't care. But anyway, let me write those formulas down for you again. The two that you need, that, like I said, there are a lot of formulas that you can have them. The future, or you can use a calculator, but this one, the future value is the present value times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. Now remember that K is the periodic interest rate. So if I were to tell you that... Denny's. Wait. So if I were to tell you that the interest rate, the annual, the APR, is 10%, and I said compound it semi-annually, you put 10%, 0.10 divided by 2. In there. Don't ever forget to do that, for God's sake. And if I told you that it was for 6 years, in the numerator you would put 6 times 2. The interest divide, the time multiply. Don't get too confused or you'll get some really weird answers. And that's, by the way, that's one of the things about these formulas and these calculations. If you make a mistake, it's probably going to look really wrong. I mean, you can be off with your rounding, and that's something you got to watch out for, is rounding error. But, I mean, as far as getting the right answer or something that's close, if you make a mistake in one of these problems, the answer is probably going to be way out there in left field. A couple of years ago, a student came into my office. I had him calculate, and we'll do this next week, calculate the loan payment on a car. And she came up with a monthly loan payment of $10,652, I think it was. I said, well, does that even make sense to you? And she said, I don't know. My dad pays my car payments. And, you know, it's one of the things where I'm glad I don't conceal carry or I kill myself sometimes. But anyway, now flip this formula around and you can get present values. The present value would be the future value divided by, or to the negative t. And like I said, you'll usually see me use the negative exponent instead of in the denominator because it's one less screw up I can do, forgetting parentheses or something like that. Okay. Those are two core formulas that... It's faster to do them that way than to try to figure out how to do it on a financial calculator. They're built more for more complex cash flows. And for heaven's sake, the tables. I mean, if you actually do this in real life, you're not going to have use tables. You're going to use Excel spreadsheets or you're going to use a calculator for what you do. But anyway, those are the two. Now, what our goal in finance is to find out whether or not, well, one of our goals is whether or not an investment is worth our trouble. If it is, we'll say yes. If it's not, we'll say no. And our rules are actually extraordinarily simple. And in a case like this, we might say, all right, we've got two different projects that we could take on. You got two different projects, and I'm going to show you something here. It's actually quite useful, and I strongly encourage you. You'll see me actually use it quite a bit, too. It's called a timeline. Timelines lay out the pattern of cash flows across time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a timeline for two different projects. Now, these are mutual exclusive. You can do one or you can do the other. And I'm going to lay out 5 years. So what I'm looking for is which of these projects is going to be worth more. Suppose that one of the projects pays us $200 in the first year, and then in the third year, it pays us $400. Another project, let me kill this light here. There, that looks a little bit. And another project doesn't start paying us until the second year, at which time it pays us $300, and then in 5 years it pays us another $600. The question is then, which one of these projects should I take? Because as it stands now, well, one project pays us a total of $600. No, it doesn't. Absolutely not. That's one of the common myths of the common person. There is no $600 anywhere in that first project. There isn't. It just isn't there. And that, as in the second project, there is no $900 in that project anywhere. We've got to turn these into now dollars because these two are absolutely incompatible. One is like inches and feet, and the other is like centimeters and meters. And so we got to, first of all, bring all of these cash flows back to the present. And that's probably where you'll use this formula, the present value formula, just straight up on its own. There's one thing I forgot. There's one more piece of information you'll need before I can go anywhere with this. Do you know what it is? Can you see it? What am I missing? That I can't do anything until I know one more thing. Yeah, the discount rate. I mean, I can't discount cash flows without a discount a rate. So in this case, let's say that my discount rate for the cash flows in these two cases is 10%. You're kind of risky. A higher discount rate conveys greater risk. Okay, always remember that. Interest rates are a reflector of risk. So a low-risk project, I would put a low discount rate on. Higher-risk projects, a higher discount rate on. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to honk these two back. This PV, present value here, would be the $200 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative first plus $400 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative third. Now notice that there is no compounding issue here because the cash flows are annual and I didn't say anything at all in this exercise about them being different. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Hang on. If I can figure out how to do this. Oh. There you go. That's a 3 up there. Okay, so there's that. Now, What I'm going to do is real quick, just so you can see it in action here. I'm going to put in a, I brought up a TI-83 emulator, and I'll show you a little more about that once this problem's over. Okay, and in this case, turn it on, and I'm just going to do, what was that, 200 times 1 plus 0.0, I could actually just wipe 1.10 to the I can't even see that thing. Is that the y to the, where the hell's y to the x?
It's a little variable division sign.
Oh, there. Man, it's been a while. Okay, to the, and 1 posneg plus, now be, whoa, I can't do it that way. That's right. I have to put in parentheses, I have to put in parentheses to the negative 1. I'm doing real good here. To the negative 1, we'll get there one of these days. 1, close the parentheses, plus. And then the other one was $400 in 3 years. 400 times 1.1 plus, and I'm being a little bit long-winded here in this just to for the first time, to the open parentheses, negative 3, close the parentheses. And I get a present value of the cash flows totaled together of $482.34. $482.34. Now I'm going to do the other one. See how that one. That one was, had a time on the timeline. $300 occurred in year 3, so I'm going to have 300 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative third. I don't know if I even need that negative, those parentheses around that, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then I had out there 5 years out, 600. Times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative fifth power. Close the parentheses. Close it out. Oh, well.
It was to the second year, 300.
Yeah. It was, and I didn't close the parentheses. See, I talk and then I can't write and chew gum at the same time, so I pay the price for it. Okay, try it one more time. Okay. Insert. That didn't work. You know what? Shut the hell up. close parentheses to the open parentheses. Negative 5. Wow. It's been a while since I've used an emulator like this. Thought this would be a good exercise. Was that to the... Oh, you're right. That was to the second power, wasn't it? Yeah. So I'm going to have to change that. Enter. Second, enter. And then bring that back up here to the 2. $620 and 49 cents. So now we have a clear, a much, much clearer answer to the problem that was at hand. Simply that, going back to the document camera, going back to the doc, good. We see that the second project, even though the cash flows occur later, that is the more desirable of the two projects. That is the one we would say yes. There is no if and or and but. There's no, well, we like that first project better. Doesn't matter. The hard numbers tell us that the second project is the one that we take. Now, as far as the discount rate goes, early in the course, I will do something special to get my discount rates. I'll pull them out of my ass. Later, I will show you how we actually derive discount rates for projects. And that is a worthwhile thing because that is the basis of project valuation. It's the basis of stock and bond price evaluation. About everything in finance pivots on these present and future values, as well as on the discount rates that we choose. And notice that the discount rate is going to drive decision making, because a high discount, any discount rate has more impact as time goes on. So, in other words, higher discount rates will tend to impact projects that have longer term cash flows more than they will impact projects that have shorter term cash flows. And it can even get more intense than that, because there is an argument that it's actually a kind of a hot topic, and I got involved in it and nearly got kicked off a message board about it. Is 10% really the right interest rate for both of these? Two things are in order. One is kind of obviously, do I know these projects have the same risk? If they don't have the same risk, then I should not be using the same discount rate for the two projects. A lot of times in real life business, they will make the assumption that we use this discount rate. And they won't ask that subtler question, well, should we be using the same discount rate for different projects? Because it could have different risk. Then there's a subtler point that's finally, after years and years, starting to show up in the literature in kind of a snobbish sort of way. These financial planning people were talking about how we're entering a new era of retirement planning and all that, where we have what are called defined contribution plans, DCPs. And the problem is that we have a hard time having a lot of people, especially poorer people, lower income, working class, working poor, who will not put money aside for retirement. They will find whatever way they can to avoid it. And the term that was used by this one person who's kind of a bigwig in the business was they're irrational. In fact, they have this almost sneering term for these people. They say they hyperbolically discount the future. In other words, these low-life dumbbells who we have to manage now and force into retirement plans are so stupid that they put massively high interest rates on future cash flows, especially cash flows that occur much farther in the future. They would rather have $100 and spend it now than put that $100 in the bank and spend it in 20 years. And these financial planning gurus are saying, well, they're just irrational. They're dumb. We've just got to force them to do it. And I jumped in and did the academic equivalent of eating their asses, saying, you have all along assumed that everyone would have the same discount rate. And that there is a market discount rate, yes, there is, but that market discount rate is everybody's market discount rate. Instead of considering the possibility that different constituencies might have different discount rates for the same project. Well, that was too close to violating the law of one price. And so it got ugly on that board. I called them some names. That's okay. The thing, though, is that you see, for purposes that are in corporate finance as it exists now, and you'll intersect with this if you're not in finance, you'll still intersect with this, there's going to be a discount rate. And they're going to say, use that, don't ask why, or if you're one of the ones who calculates the discount rate, you're going to calculate one. You're not going to complicate the matter by calculating several different ones for different projects. Now, let me show you something here. A couple of points that need to be made about what we're doing here. First things first, and I'm going to get another piece of paper here show you the next point here. Looking around here, woman, do you play the lottery?
No.
Okay, good, good. You? No. Okay, the Powerball, $1.3 billion. I mean, I bought $20 worth of tickets. I won $4. It pisses me off. I know better. But anyway, the thing of it is, though, here's how a lottery would work. Let's say we got a lottery where you win $1 million. You want $1 million. Well, you're not going to get $1 million. You know that, right? They're going to give it to you, $50,000 a year for 20 years. They will give you $50,000 a year for 20 years. That's what you're going to get. So is there any $1 million anywhere in that? Say no. No. There is no $1 million anywhere in that frickin' jackpot. It is $50,000 a year, each year for 20 years. That is not the same as $1 million. It's not even close to $1 million, in fact. Now, they would offer you a lump sum if you say, screw that, I'm one of those hyperbolic discounters, I want all my money now. They'd probably give you about $600,000. Again, though, they're not stupid. They know there's no $1 million. There's nowhere in anything in a lottery the stated jackpot. It's just not there. It's just a story that they tell because people believe that there are many people who don't understand that $50,000 a year for 20 years is not $1 million. It has nothing to do with $1 million other than that 50,000 times 20 equals $1 million, but that has nothing to do with this. This is finance. It's not arithmetic. Just keep that in mind. Now, so that's the first thing you've got to understand is that the lump values of money really, really don't mean much to us. Well, they don't mean anything to us. There was since time immemorial, and I actually saw a couple of older business fellows still using it. There was an old method of deciding whether to go with a project or not called the payback period method. It works like this, and this is the way it used to be for all businesses did this until we started getting people through finance business programs, maybe starting in the 30s and 40s, we started finally getting past it, but the payback period works like this. All right, let's say a project costs $1,000. Well, their way of calculating whether to go with the project or not is they would decide, okay, we take projects only if they pay back the original investment within a certain period of years. And every business kind of had its own. I ran into these two guys, they were old guys, and they ran a business, and they had a rule. Every project has to pay itself back within 5 years. So in other words, if you had a project, this is not what it was. It was a much bigger project. But it was like, okay, it costs $1,000. It's going to pay $100 the first year, $200 the second year, $300 the third year, $200 the fourth year, $200 fifth year, $200 the sixth year. Well, they said no to it because those numbers didn't add up to $1,000 by year five. So they just rejected the project, straight up. Even though this project was going to crank at $200 in years, I think it was like, sort of like 4 years through, year four through year nine, and then it would tail off to $100 for a couple of years. It was obviously a positive project as far as present value goes, but they said no because they didn't consider the discounted cash flows involved. They just took absolute numbers. Well, this doesn't get us our $1,000 back in 5 years, so we're just not going to do it. One, they didn't consider present value, discounted cash flows. Two, the 5 years, they were just pulling that out of their asses. I mean, that was just they had thought up 5 years probably 30, 40 years before I met them, and they just held to that. So that payback period method of project evaluation was still out there, and in fact, it's been so recently observed in real business that they still mention it in finance textbooks and say, don't do this. Anyway, that aside. You decide that you need a car. Now, you want one of those. You want something that makes you look really impressive. So you're going to get a Miev, okay? Or maybe a Prius. Or possibly a Juke. Or what are those cubic, those things that look like Dadaist cubes driving down the road? Don't they recall for ugly anymore? You would think they would. Anyway, okay, you're going to get a real cool car. Now, you have seen the ad on TV. Come to Al's dealership. We have a low interest, 0.99% APR. Buy from us at 0.99% APR. Now, what do you say to that? I want you to be a cynical old bastard like me.
No.
There ain't no 0.99% anywhere in there. They are lying. Okay, the technical term is they're lying mofos. Okay? The deal is this, and I'm going to show you an actual example. This is actually what it was. Went to a furniture store a couple of years back. I was looking at different cabinets, high boys. They used to be called high boys. And they had this, we'll carry you on financing for one full year. And this one cabinet there, $1,500. And that, what the hell? Whoa, thought I had a small stroke. I look up there and I see white. That's usually what you see right before you die, you know. Anyway, and he kept emphasizing, and we carry you for one full year on this. And I said, well, what if I'm going to pay cash. And then his eyes just went, beam. Well, if you're going to pay cash, well, goddamn, we're going to sell it to you for $1,200 out the door. Oh. So, now we can calculate the interest rate that was actually hidden in that price. 1 year out at $1,500. Divided by the now investment of 1,200, and you always subtract one from these. There was the interest rate. He told me it was 0% financing. We're just going to carry you because we're that kind of people. Yes, indeed. In fact, if he's going to actually take 1,200 now, as opposed to $1,500 in 1 year, there is an interest rate of 25% on that money. It was just pure. So when you go to that car dealership and you get 1.99% or 0.99%, you're not getting that. They are embedding the actual interest rate in a higher price on the car. You work it out, and in most examples, you'll find that if you say to them, "All right, I don't need your financing person. Don't send me into that sad glass office over there where that creepy guy in the white shirt is. I'll finance this myself. I'll go to my credit union, my bank, whatever. Don't make me go over there." You'll find out that the price of that car drops very quickly. A study done just a couple of years, well, it's not a couple of years ago, it was in 2009, found that the actual interest rate, if they go in, they negotiate a car price paying for it, and then they would compare that to the interest rate that was being claimed, they found that the interest rates were actually running at about 14 to 16%. You could do a lot better than that with a bank or a credit union, but it looks so good, 1.99%, and I can get my financing right there in this building. Their whole deal is they want you to walk out the door with the keys to that car. It's called the utility of ownership in marketing. You might have even heard it in a class if you had any marketing. We want to transfer that ownership as fast as possible. We'll put you in that building, in that office, so that we can finance you. We'll make you feel good about the financing. It's 1.99%, and you won't even feel the price of that car, which is actually pulsating about $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 more. Here's the interesting upshot of this. There used to be, and there still are in many states, what are called anti-usury laws. There are laws that prohibit interest rates that are too high, that are excessive, that are usury, they use people. These anti-usury laws have been on the books for actually since the Middle Ages. And in the United States, in common law, there's a consideration that interest rates too high are an abomination. So there was a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court some years back in the 90s, I guess, where they said these companies that hit you with fees and charges are actually embedding, and premiums on price are actually embedding an interest rate that is above the statutory limits under anti-usury laws. In other words, when you are charged a fee, or when you are charged a premium, you're actually being charged an interest rate. And if you calculate these interest rates are just staggeringly high. Well, the Supreme Court took it under consideration, and given that they were all a bunch of dumbasses about anything related to business, absolute idiots, they said, well, that's not an interest rate. It's not called an interest rate. It's a fee. So in other words, as long as you lie and say that it's a fee, you can get by with charging an interest rate that is illegal. Because our U.S. Supreme Court said you can do that, even though that's just complete nonsense. It is an interest rate. Let me give you an example. I had a CEO of a credit union here in town speak to the Illinois State students in finance a couple of weeks ago. He was a very nice guy, love him to death, and he was explaining that credit unions are under a great deal of pressure because there are only certain ways that they can generate revenue. Their investments that they can make on deposits are pretty narrow and tight. And interest rates are so low, they're making hardly anything off those. So they have to find new innovative ways to generate revenue, or they'll be out of business. Well, here's one of the ways that they do it. Have you ever overdrawn your checking account? Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have made checks that were so rubbery, I could have made them into scuba suits. But at the same time, I am not ashamed to admit, yes, I needed ramen noodles, so I bought them, damn it. Okay? Here's the deal, though. The credit unions have a brilliant new plan, a brilliant new thing. You can sign an agreement that they will actually let you overdraft your account. It's a new marketing thing. Would you like to be able to overdraw your account and we won't bitch at you at all? It's okay. You can overdraw your account up to $100.
Infinite money.
I know, right? You know? Ramen noodles and with the extra pork sauce. I know, right? Yeah.
Beans and rice with that.
Oh, those give me the wind. Something fierce. But anyway, you're not stupid. I overdrew my account. You read the fine print. Oh, the overdraft fee is $50. So I overdrafted last month $4. And about 20 days later, I got my next check. 20 days. I mean, it was bad last night. You know, Christmas and all that. I mean, I went to Dollar Tree 3 times. But anyway, the thing of it is, though, that for about $4, they charged me a fee of $50. $4, a fee of $50. But it's not an interest rate. It was just a fee. I agreed to it. And I was so damn grateful to them. You see, they created in me and in the people who sign these agreements this feeling that they're doing us a favor. Like hell they are. No one does you a favor, not even your mom. She's just afraid that she won't get sainted after she dies when she does nice things for you. Let's look at it. Let's say it had actually been a month. They carried me for a month, okay? So in order for us to find out what the actual interest rate was, what I would have to do is I would take 50 divided by 4, and I would then, 50 divided by 4, and that was a month, so I would have to raise that to the 12th power minus 1 to get the effective yield. Because there are 12 months in a year to get an APR on this. Because this happened for just a month. A $4 investment cost me $50 for 1 month. So in order to turn that into an annualized rate, I'd have to bring it up to the 12th freaking power. And you always subtract 1 from these when you calculate effective rates. And I'm sneaking in a little formula for effective rates on you here. But what I'm going to do here is I am going to switch back over to that TI-83 calc. Why does it turn off online? No, seriously. Is it going to run out of battery if it doesn't? Is it? Look at that. It turned off. Oh, by the way. Yeah, it thinks it does. It's wrong. By the way, no one has ever told you this. When you get your calculator in your hand, look in the upper right-hand corner. If the button in the upper right-hand corner says no, you got the calculator upside down. Oh, shut up. Okay, I'm trying here. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take 50 divided by 4, and then I'm going to raise that to the 12th power, and then I'm going to subtract 1. You always subtract 1 because in math, there is really not such a thing as a rate. It's 1 plus the rate is what happens in math. So to bring it back to common language, you have to do this. And then this is, by the way, what's going to come out of here is a decimal. I have to times it by 100 to turn it back into a percent. Watch. Did you just see that? No, seriously, noobs. I just multiplied that by 100 and it didn't do anything. Okay, I'll do it on my own, damn it. 145.52% was the interest rate annualized. 140. Now, here's a historical little tidbit for your Trivial Pursuit games. They used to burn people at the stake for this. Seriously. North of 145% was the interest rate that I was, annualized interest rate that I was charged on this money. Now, if that doesn't bunch your boxers, frost your underwear, and turn your ass. But the courts have, the law of the land is, it's not an interest rate. It's just a fee. If it were an interest rate, the banks would tell you it's an interest rate. Yeah. Why isn't that? I'm going to try that one more time. God, that irritates me for some reason. I keep wanting to do it just to be pissed off. Anyway. Okay. Now this, yeah.
How do you find out the interest rate on the car you'd be buying if you're not paying it in cash?
Okay, the best way you would do it is to find out, just say, all right, I want to pay cash. I'm going to bring a cashier's check. I'll have it, see what happens to the price, okay? Then what you do, and this would require that you use a calculator to do it, because it's an annuity stream of cash flows. But from there, what you do is you'd say, all right, I am paying an extra $4,000 right up front. and then you would back into the interest rate that would be required for that to happen. I'm actually going to show you how to do it in next week, how you can actually calculate it. But it would just stagger you. In many cases, in one case I know, because it was a car I bought, I calculated that the interest rate, I got the loan from a credit union, it came out to be like 8.7%. But when I calculated what they were going to charge me before they knew I was going to pay it without their financing arm, it came out that the interest rate was close to 17%. It was staggering. Even though they said our rate at that time was 4.99%, that wasn't what it was. It was much higher because of that additional amount right up front that I was going to be carrying in my payments for the 60-month life of that loan. And we're going to do those. That's one of the most useful things I can teach you in this course. But one thing I am going to show you here is I snuck in a little formula here. When you have compounding that is more than annual, when something happens faster than an annual, the APR, the annual percentage rate, what is told to you isn't the actual real interest rate. The real interest rate is a nudge above it, or a big bump above it in some cases. We call this is caused by the effect of compounding. Let me explain what happened. Back in the it was well before the 1920s, the banking system was just a wild west of just crooks, criminals, dog beaters, nose pickers, con men, the whole nine yards. Banks were pyramid schemes. Banks were filled with con men and liars. There were good, decent bankers, but they didn't last in a world of wolves. Lambs tend to be eaten. Now, they were running scams. One of them was a scam that worked like this. It was classic. Okay, you're a kind of a rich person. I'll tell you what. You invest 10 grand with my bank, and I'll pay you a 25% return on your savings. Well, that sounds incredible. So you give me the $10,000 to invest. Well, you know what I do with it? I spend it on myself. I mean, I'm worth it. Well, then you're going to want your money back. So what I do is I find this wealthier guy. I'll tell you what. You got $30,000 to invest. I can do you 50% on your savings account. Well, of course, you give me. Then I pay you back your 10 grand with 25%, and then I spend the rest of it on myself. Well, come time for you to come to me, then I come to Mr. Rich Person here, and you've got like $1 million, and I mean, okay, this is only for my friends, 100% interest rate. And you say, okay, so I take that, and I take some of them and pay you off, and then I spend the rest. And then it turns out you're a real asshole. You're going to come and beat the hell out of me, so I've got to work real fast. So I go to this very powerful trust fund. We've got this program going on now, and it's only for my best friends connected through the community here in New York City, and we'll hook you up because I know you. This isn't for anyone else. This is just for you. 500% interest, okay? But you got to invest $50 million with me. Well, of course, you've heard good things from these people there, so you invest, and I take care of you, and now I've got you on the hook. This is Bernie Madoff's scheme, okay? Bernie Madoff was doing this. He was a famous, he eventually went to prison, but somewhere along the line, you're running that much money, and you think that you're somehow so special that you deserve something that this common thing shouldn't get. That's right. You are. I mean, nothing for you. You see, the whole point is that I don't have a whole lot of mercy for sympathy for these people who got screwed in this investment scheme. They knew they were getting something special because they thought they were special and they had special status with Bernie. But back in the 20s, this was turning into a nightmare. And the whole thing just, boom, like that, collapsed into a heaping, smoking cloud of turds, finally. So when the reform came in the 1930s, with the kicking out of all of the scoundrels from Congress and a lot of other things, The law, banking law, said there you cannot pay more, no bank can pay more than 5.25% on a passbook savings account. You cannot pay more than that. That'll end it right there. No more of these pyramid schemes with insane interest rates being offered. It's over. Well, actually, the banking system was in such a shape and money was being printed at such an incredible rate to try to crawl out of the Great Depression that real interest rates were way, way below 5.25%. So it was what we call in economics a price ceiling, but it was not an effective price ceiling. No one really noticed. But as years went by and the economy began to pick up strength, and especially after World War II when inflation began to start kicking in pretty severely, well, interest rates started bumping up, and these banks were hogtied at 5.25%. They couldn't offer more. So what they did was they started offering compounding on annual yields. There wasn't anything in the law that said they couldn't do it. And compounding has the effect of bumping an interest rate above the APR to something a little higher than that. Now, let me show you how you calculate it. It's actually a really simple formula. All you do is take the, and this is called the effective yield. And interestingly enough, the law requires now that when you take out a loan, that somewhere in the fine print they tell you what the effective yield is, as well as the APR. So in other words, when you get a car loan for like 6%, that's the APR, but the actual interest rate, the effective interest rate, is actually some more than that because it's compounding monthly, because your payments are monthly. But here's the trick. What you do is you take 1 plus the APR divided by the number of compoundings per year to the number of compoundings per year. You don't worry about the year, how many years there are. Don't screw, doesn't matter how much money it is. It's really an easy formula. So let me show you what it would be. Okay, let me put number of compoundings so if we had one compounding per year, that would be 5.25%. Now watch what happens when you do two compoundings per year. I hope I didn't take that off the screen. Yeah, no, I did. And it turned off again. Serious? Anyway, for some reason that annoys me too today. Okay, you take 1 plus 0.0525. Remember, always use decimals. Interestingly enough, financial calculators, if you're doing the finance functions on them, they take percentages. But if you're doing just real actual math, put in the decimal version. Okay, so I'll divide by 2, close the parentheses, and then I'll raise it to the second power. Oh, I forgot, minus 1. Minus 1. My ass. Is there some reason I suck at this today? Oh, I put minus 1. There. Happy? 5.32%. You see how what happened? You just bumped up above the statutory 5.25. Now let's do 4 a year. I would do open parentheses 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 4. And raise it to the fourth power, minus 1, 5.35. Quarterly would be 5.35%. So the effective yield essentially is conveying what is actually happening. The APR is no longer the interest rate you're actually paying once there are more than one compounding per year. Now let me show you one where you get a car loan. Let's take a car loan at, let's say, 6.99%. That's the APR. That's what will be told you on the TV and in the big print on your contract. The effective yield, like I said, is in there somewhere. They have to disclose that to you, but it's not always very evident. So let's say that you were taking a car loan out and monthly payments. Now remember, it doesn't matter how much you're taking out, and it doesn't matter how many years it is. The effective yield formula doesn't need those. Divided, so it would be open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0699 divided by 12 compoundings, that is 12 payments per year, to the 12th power minus 1. So your actual, your effective rate is 7.22% on that loan. And that's that effective compounding. You're paying 12 payments a year, then your actual interest rate is higher than the APR. Now, it sounds like that's the bad side. There's actually a bright side to this. It works like this, and this is why some banks actually won't let you do it anymore. When you take out a home loan, like let's say a 30-year home loan, if you can afford to do it and the bank doesn't have a prohibition in your promissory agreement, making a two payments a month actually creates the reverse effect, and you end up paying the loan in not 15 years. It's a 30-year loan. If you paid two payments a month, you would end up paying in about 12 and a half years. You would pay the loan off, because it would be like a reverse of the effective yield effect on your loan. So keep that in mind, that if you can possibly do it, and this is true with cars, it's true with any kind of loan you take out. If you can handle a couple of payments a month, then do it, because you'll end the loan faster than half the time. And that's why it is now, I've seen some banks that say you can't do that. Other banks actually are now charging a fee, assessing a fee to you if you pay more than one payment in every month. And if you calculate that fee into it, it actually destroys your trick and makes the effective rate on the loan higher than it was to begin with. Their fee is that nasty because they don't like you to do it, because essentially you're paying off the loan before they want you to. And you're actually thwarting their effective yield trick that they're doing on you. That's all I have for you. Go home.